Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of September 17th, 2019. This week, we look at the fetal heartbeat abortion bill Senate lawmakers recently received testimony on. We have the Post and Courier's Jamie Lovegrove and Jeffrey Collins with the Associated Press to discuss the initial hearing of the House-approved bill that would ban virtually all abortions in South Carolina. And we always want to hear from you on all the topics we discuss on The Lead, so interact with us on Twitter or Instagram at SCLEDEPOD. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. Make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes, where you can rate and review us. We're also everywhere podcasts exist, including the NPR One app. You can listen to all four sections of our podcast while you think of $10 words you can use to annoy your friends. No, I'm not being real recalcitrant, AT. You see what I work with, season three. Or while you wish your mom a happy birthday like I'm doing right now. Happy birthday, Mom. Okay, everyone, call your mother, say hi. That's my gift to you, Mom, along with the roses. You're welcome. Quorum, call your mother. Now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Also, if you want to be our intern, send Amy Crouch an email. It is paid now. You'll also work on This Week in South Carolina. We could use you. We're looking at you, college-age students in the Columbia area. Email Amy Crouch, A-C-R-O-U-C-H, at scetv.org. Number one, the Post and Courier reports that the National Labor Relations Board ruled that flightline workers at Boeing's North Charleston plant can't join the International Association of Machinists Union as their own separate group. The board said the proposed flightline bargaining unit of just two job descriptions did not meet federal standards because the workers aren't distinct from the site's overall workforce of about 2,700 maintenance and production workers. The 3-1 decision overturns an earlier ruling by the board's regional director in Atlanta. All three members were appointed to the board by President Donald Trump. Number two, the state newspaper reports that a South Carolina court says Amazon owes the state sales tax from transactions third-party vendors have made while selling goods to SC shoppers through the online retail giant's website. The ruling does not specify the amount that Amazon owes the state. South Carolina Department of Revenue now will calculate the specific amount of taxes owed on the sales at issue in this case. This comes after more than $40 million has flowed to the state since a 2018 U.S. Supreme Court decision that said states could slap a sales tax on online retailers without a physical presence in the state. Number three, speaking of spending money, the Post and Courier reports that a College of Charleston analysis found the region's visitor industry saw an estimated $58.6 million loss due to Hurricane Dorian. That storm, which skirted the South Carolina coast, brought wind, rain, and evacuation orders for the area. Now, for some perspective, CFC's Office of Tourism found that last year's Hurricane Florence caused a $111 million loss to the tourism industry. And number four, the Post and Courier reports that a bill permanently banning drilling off the Atlantic and Pacific coasts passed the U.S. House of Representatives along party lines. First Congressional District Democrat Joe Cunningham sponsored the bill, which would also bring back tighter oil and gas drilling rules to the Gulf of Mexico that were put in place after the Deepwater Horizon explosion. House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn supports the bill, but was absent from the vote. As for the rest of the state's congressional delegation, all five Republicans voted against the measure. And now for our Florida Man News segment. Every week, we give you just a headline, a taste of the most captivating Florida Man news. Headline, Florida men, that's a first, Florida men arrested for pulling gun on McDonald's employee for giving them cold burgers. And just like that first how you doing text in your DMs with cuffing season right around the corner, hey, tell your new mate to listen to The Lead or make it an ultimatum, whatever. I don't want to get involved, but just listen. We buried The Lead. Yes, it is still the legislative offseason here in South Carolina, but Senate lawmakers heard testimony last week on what is set to be one of the most controversial bills of the session, the fetal heartbeat abortion bill. The subcommittee took no action on the bill. It only heard testimony from more than 50 people on it. The bill would ban abortions once a heartbeat is detected around 6 weeks, essentially banning all abortions in South Carolina. This bill, H. 3020, passed the House in April by a vote of 64 to 22, but its future in the Senate is uncertain due to several factors. To focus on all that and break down what happened last week, we have Jeffrey Collins of the Associated Press and Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier. Welcome to Season 3, guys.
Excited.
Wow. Incredibly exciting.
Especially for you, Jamie.
New frontiers.
Since you are our Season 2 leader, most stars on the board, our star chart, means you had the most appearances. How many? I didn't even count before. Two, four, like at least 40.
Wow.
Even though we've only had 75 episodes, at least 40.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right.
Which means we have to give you a pizza party at some point, Jimmy. We owe you one from season one.
My double pizza parties. Yeah. Well, I would just like to thank the Academy for this great honor and
my parents. The music starts playing. No, we'll have a party with all the contributors, and maybe we'll get some of our fans out there. Of course, we'll have a big pizza party, but only one person named Jamie Lovegrove will get a free pizza. It's no big deal. Everyone has to pay, whatever. But that aside, let's get into the topic of this week. And Jeffrey, kind of lead us off about what this bill is, H. 3020, and what it would do if it was passed into law in South Carolina.
It's a bill similar to one that's passed in about a half a dozen other conservative states. It's called the Heartbeat Abortion Bill. Basically, it bans almost all abortions once a fetus's heartbeat can be detected, which is usually around 6 weeks of pregnancy. The issue with that, depending on which side you're on, obviously, if you support this bill, it comes down to the crux of what people that want more restrictions on abortion have always said. You know, abortion stops a beating heart. Well, you know, this is the beating heart. There you go. You know, heartbeat determines your life. That's what the folks that want this bill would argue. The opponents of this bill would argue many women, in fact, most women don't even know they're pregnant before they're 6 weeks into it. I mean, you know, so it would essentially ban all abortions because, you know, just physiologically, a woman doesn't know she's pregnant before then. So, and right now it's in court. So, you know, the states that have passed this bill, none of them have been able to put it into effect yet because there's court challenges. So that's kind of where this bill is at in South Carolina. It passed the House, as you said. The governor enthusiastically supports it. So right now, the only thing between it and law is the Senate.
Jamie, what did we see happen in that subcommittee hearing? We heard from the chairman, Shane Martin, say, hey, we're not going to take any votes this week. We're just getting testimony. So really, what was, I guess, the point of having that meeting right now here in September?
You know, they want to put this through the process, and they want to make sure that everyone feels like they are being heard and that some of the most involved activists on both sides of this debate have a chance to voice their opinions on it directly to lawmakers while this is moving through the process. The reason why they're holding this now in the off session, you know, they do hold hearings during the off session, is not entirely uncommon. It's fairly rare we've seen it on abortion issues. But the reason that they are doing it now is because they want to eventually move it through the subcommittee, move it through the committee, and get it onto the Senate floor for early in the 2020 session so that they can basically deal with the issue one way or another, get it out of the way, and move on to the many other issues they want to tackle in 2020. The issue is as fraught as ever, as Jeffrey is describing, and the fact that several other states have now passed it adds an interesting dynamic to this. You know, South Carolina and South Carolina Republicans have long wanted to be on the front lines of this national debate. I remember talking to some abortion, or, you know, anti-abortion activists, you know, a while back, who dreamed that someday there will be South Carolina v. Roe will be the case that overturns Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. And so they want to be a part of that. You know, the states that have passed already have already had to spend significant legal fees on defending it in court. And that's been part of the argument from the opponents of this bill. You know, Susan Dunn, who is the legal director of the South Carolina ACLU, testified at that hearing. You know, South Carolina is a poor state. Why do we need to add our name to this lawsuit, spend our money on this lawsuit that's already in the courts at this point? You know, South Carolina being added to it would not really change the situation. It's the same bill, pretty much. Some of the other bills don't even have exceptions for rape or incest, like this one now does. But that's the idea, you know, and obviously, ultimately, what these folks want, what John McCravey, the House representative from Greenwood, who sponsored this bill, wants, is to get the Supreme Court to reconsider Roe v. Wade. And he argues that they might not necessarily have to overturn it completely. What they could do is change the standard of viability. What it's been said as before is, you know, the fetus would have to be able to live outside the womb. That typically happens at around 24 weeks. Mm-hmm. If the Supreme Court was to change the standard of viability to when a heartbeat is detected, then you could potentially give states the opportunity to set their limits at that date as opposed to 24 weeks. So that's the legal thinking there.
And, you know, it's funny, this issue, what I find interesting at this issue is, I mean, you know, this is something that people come to their conclusions about how they feel about it after a lot of prayer, a lot of, you know, a lot of meditation on it. Mm-hmm. But ultimately what that means is that, you know, people are very entrenched in what they think. I mean, I don't think it's that far afield to say there weren't barely any, if any, minds changed based on the testimony that was taken.
Right.
But the what that means is this becomes a very political issue because you're not going to change people's minds. You know, whether or not this thing gets any kind of hearing at all next year kind of comes down to a Republican caucus meeting in November or December when, right, you know, Majority Leader Shane Massey is going to get everybody together, all the Republican senators together, talk to them about what they think. They've got to have a two-thirds majority to shut down any filibuster. And they have one Republican that won't shut down a filibuster just on his own philosophical reasons. Whatever the issue was, he's not going to shut it down. So he's got to hold on to every single Republican vote. And, you know, I talked to him before this hearing, and, you know, he says, if I can't guarantee the votes, we have so many things. We have Santee Cooper. We have all education, all these things that come up. There's no sense in bogging down days or weeks of valuable Senate debate time if it's not going to get anywhere. So right, we may know before the session starts where things stand.
And especially in the last year of a session, everything's on the table and it's, you know, come early May, things are done. I mean, that's what sine die in early May is. I mean,
right,
it's got to start all over again. And that's also something we heard last year, especially from like senators. I mean, they were just, anytime you brought up abortion, they kind of rolled their eyes and said, we don't need to bring it up. Like, why are we talking about it? Like that. And then it came out of the House in April and then things started kind of moving over in the Senate. But obviously they had other priorities to deal with. They pushed it off to this year, the off session. But Jamie, it looked like you had something to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jeffrey touched on an important point there, which is that this hearing this past week is really much more about trying to sway public opinion, and trying to sort of begin the rhetorical battle between these two sides, than it is really about swaying these lawmakers, almost all of whom are very dug in. The Republicans almost unanimously support this. The Democrats almost unanimously oppose it. There was a time, you know, not that long ago, when there were a lot more pro-choice Republicans, there were a lot more pro-life Democrats than there are today. Right now, it's very divided along party lines. You know, at the end of the day, this debate is really going to come down to a very small handful of folks who are sort of somewhere in the middle, partly because of their views on the filibuster. You know, folks like Senator Leatherman, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, former president pro tem, and Senator Luke Rankin, from Conway, the Judiciary Committee chairman. They have both tended to be very reluctant to shut down a Democratic filibuster on this. They have kind of taken the approach of let them speak. And then you might have some folks who are sort of in the middle of the issue, too, like Sandy Senn from Charleston, who's in a very competitive district down there and is, you know, going to be running for re-election next year. It'll be interesting to see how she approaches this. She was kind of caught in the middle during the personhood debate.
Personhood was really different for a lot of people.
Right. So, you know, the votes are very much, in a lot of ways, pretty much baked in the cake here. The question is going to be on the absolute margins. You know, when are folks going to be willing to sit down, you know, a Marlon Kimson or a Mike Fanning or a Brad Hutto, you know, Mia McLeod, anyone who might be filibustering this bill? That's going to be the question as we enter the session.
And again, especially as we said, you start chewing through these days and these weeks on a very tight calendar with education reform and Santee Cooper on the agenda.
Right.
Well, and you can even boil it down even further into the politics of this, you know, as Jamie alluded to, it's an election year. And the magic of the election year in the SC House and the SC Senate is filing happens before the session. So smack in the middle of the session, you know, towards the end of March. So, you know, does someone like Senator Sandy Senn in Charleston wait and see who her primary opponents are? Do they give her the time to do that? And if she has a very right challenger coming hard from her right, does that affect how she thinks? I mean, I don't know. That and it'll be interesting to see if the leadership in the Senate, the Republican leadership in the Senate, wants to go ahead and push this out immediately and get it resolved and done, or if they want to wait and let these people see who they're running against, who's
might
coming up.
Primary or something like that.
That is an interesting point.
And that's probably something I'm guessing they're going to be talking about at this retreat.
And typically, sort of as Jeffrey is alluding to, you know, oftentimes in these election year sessions, absolutely nothing of significance happens.
Shh, Jamie, don't.
Until
I've got to have a podcast all year next year.
they debate things, but what I'm saying is they don't vote on the most controversial bills until after the filing period is over, because that way they don't inspire a primary challenger through their January vote on some controversial issue. If, because of the fact that they want to get this out of the way and not have it hanging there for the whole session, they feel like they have to do it in January, that's going to be an interesting sort of anomaly in that process, because we are going to have that vote then before the filing period. It'll give an opportunity for potential primary challengers to emerge.
And then that can annoy, you know, that can have ramifications for lawmakers with leadership too, and say, oh, if you're going to hang me out to dry, then let's see you try and get some other things through without my support. So, and then also you think about, what if they amend the bill to be even more extreme, and then you vote against this amended bill that, you know, outlaws all abortions, and then you're on the record ahead of, you know, primary filing saying that you voted against it because you don't want to go that extreme, and then that can become a campaign ad against you in some ways.
Well, exactly. And, I mean, if you're playing way out ahead and you're in a district that's competitive, I mean, do you have a really strong Democratic challenger, too, if all of a sudden, you know, you run to the right for your primary, and then, I mean, there's not a lot of competitive districts in South Carolina, but there's a few. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so do you run so far to the right that you have – that a conservative Democrat in a 2020 year where, you know – there's a lot of stuff
more people
going
vote,
on.
Yeah, especially in presidential years.
And not just that, but, you know, the presidential election next year is going to have its own dynamic, too. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes in. I mean, it's a very complex game of, what do we want to call it, you know, 3D tic-tac-toe, Tetris, whatever you want to call it. I mean, plus to add to the end of it, the interesting thing to me to the first 2 months of the session is there's going to be a lot of attention being paid to the Democratic primary. Uh-huh. How much are reporters like me and you and Jamie and everybody, how many are going to be able to pay attention to
focus
both the Democratic primary and the State House? I wonder what's going to go on at the State House for 6 weeks while everybody's looking at the Democrats. Could be a very interesting beginning of the session.
And that was a little bit different in 2016 when Republicans were also out there doing their things too. But I'm wondering, there won't be as much attention if we're out there running around, and, you know, especially up to February 29th, which then kind of puts you into March, which means...
Right. Well, and I mean, just mentioning the Democratic primary, of course, I think we had five or so presidential candidates weigh in publicly during this hearing. You had candidates tweeting, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, I think Cory Booker and Beto O'Rourke all weighed in. And if this is happening in January or in February in the State House, right at the moment when all of these national Democratic figures are in the home stretch trying to win South Carolina Democratic voters, you could see a lot of national attention paid to this because of the fact that those candidates are going to be elevating the debate. So it'll be interesting if we do start getting more of the national spotlight on the issue and on the fact that the South Carolina State House is working on that, you know, whether or not that affects the debate in any way.
Well, and who's to say that if there is a decision made not to concentrate on abortion, that there are, you know, a dozen or more South Carolina senators that are very conservative and abortion is a very important issue to them. Mm-hmm. So who's to say that a couple of them don't get the idea to muck up the works a little bit and, you know, filibuster something else that somebody wants? And I mean, I think that hasn't happened before really here, but I could see there being a, you know, a little bit of a revolution on the way conservative side of things where they try to pull things out and say, look, we want a vote on this. We want it to come to a vote and demand that. And that, I mean, you know, there's so many different ways this can go. It'll be a very interesting issue to watch as the session gets started, along with all the other interesting issues to watch.
I was going to say, like, we're just kind of wrapping up here. You know, we didn't see any action on the bill. Obviously, they just heard testimony, but this was a pretty good strategy session that we just had here, kind of like gaming out how things might be going, because that's really where this bill stands right now. We don't, I mean, there's so many factors that could determine its future at this point. So we don't know at this point.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I would just add optically from what we took away from that hearing. You know, of course, and it should be said, frankly, that the three of us are all men.
Yes.
And that's actually somewhat reflective of the way that this debate's going to happen, because four of the 46 members of the South Carolina Senate are women, mm-hmm. two Republicans and two Democrats. A lot of folks testifying at this hearing were men. And in fact, Marjorie Bright Matthews, the senator, Democratic senator from Calden from Walterboro, mm-hmm. you know, commented on that and said that, you know, and basically implied that men shouldn't be making these decisions. But the fact is that 42 men are going to be voting on it. And we did see several anti-abortion women testify and actually really kind of forcefully push back on this notion that all women, you know, are on one side of this issue and all men are on one side of this issue. You know, this it was interesting to see that. And we even saw some, you know, sort of older women come up and testify about regretting having an abortion themselves when they were young, kind of telling a personal story about, you know, and arguing that, you know, naive young women, that their words are, you know, being duped into this. So,
and then you had other women saying, I shouldn't even have to be here to tell this story.
There was. You had a woman who told a very emotional story about when she was 18 and a half weeks pregnant, that she found out that the child she was planning to name Evan, she had already named, they had a gender reveal party.
Yeah, that was had a sad testimony.
Yeah, had a really severe brain defect. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she ultimately chose to terminate the pregnancy, and she would not have had that option, you know, if this bill had been in effect. In fact, she talked about how the fact she was even rushed in that moment because there's a 20-week limit currently in place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is a really personal issue for so many folks. That's why you see so much emotion at these types of hearings. Every single one I go to, you hear so much of the same stuff, and yet it never gets any less intense. Mm-hmm. Just because we've been through this so many times now in South Carolina does not mean that the fervor, the emotion, the passion around this issue has reduced in any way, and that's pretty striking.
Well, every single one of those 50-plus people that went to that microphone mm-hmm. had a very personal story to tell,
right?
Well, no matter how they felt about the issue or what side of the issue they were on, you have to keep in mind that when all this comes down, and you know, and the emotion comes from both sides. I mean, mm-hmm. the people that support abortion rights play defense a lot, so they end up being a little louder and everything because, you know, the folks that want more restriction on abortions, it's been a slow kind of march over, but they've slowly continued to push forward and push forward and get more and more out of it. And, you know, so when you have that kind of thing where you have a side that feels like they're getting pushed back on, and you have another side that feels like they can get to the end of where they're looking for, it creates that massive amount of motion. And to Jamie's point about the optics of it, when that hearing started, Senator Marjorie Bright Matthews, who's the only woman on that Medical Affairs Subcommittee, had a previous court appearance she had to be at. So that hearing started with not a single woman mm-hmm. listening on, you know, sub, you know, and then later Marjorie Bright Matthews came in and Senator Mia McLeod came in to also listen to it.
Right.
But the full Medical Affairs Subcommittee has only two women. It's got Marjorie Bright Matthews and Senator Sandy Sin out of Charleston. So, you know, I think that plays into it too. And the optics of who testified was very interesting too.
Right.
It got a little more balanced towards the end of the day, but certainly that first half of the day, it was mostly pastors and lawmakers on
yep.
the side supporting the bill. It was mostly women who had a very personal stake in the issue, whether they had an abortion. And it was also women OBGYNs
exactly.
were the biggest
yep.
source of it. And, you know, that plays into all this too. I mean, ultimately, is it a medical decision? Is it a moral decision? Is it, you know,
there's so many factors yeah. at play, and we're just now starting to talk about this debate that's going to clearly not stop anytime soon. So we'll be following this.
Like it.
We'll be following this
no,
all session long.
I've been
as much
in
as
South.
Again.
I've been in South Carolina almost 20 years now, covering things, and it hadn't stopped yet. So you know, it'll keep going.
Well, glad that you'll be covering with us, Jeffrey, and also thank you, Jamie, for tagging along and covering that stuff as well. We'll be watching your tweets, reading your stories as we go forward into session.
Dum,
long
dum,
march
dum.
To session starts now.
Can't wait.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Gavin.
Thanks, Gavin.
Here's some updates from the campaign trail involving 2020-related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation. Leading off, McClatchy, D.C.'s Emma Dumain asked Senator Lindsey Graham if he knew of Netherlands' Geert Wilders' anti-Islam stances before he had his photo made with him. And Graham said, quote, I never met him in my life. He said he was the opposition leader in the Netherlands and wanted to have a photo, and that's all I know. And just a follow-up to that Lindsey Graham quote, DeMaine asked if he wanted to replace John Bolton as National Security Advisor, and Graham, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, said, quote, no. Former Vice President Joe Biden picked up an endorsement from a well-known South Carolinian, Dick Riley. The former two-term South Carolina governor also served as U.S. Secretary of Education under President Bill Clinton. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg's South Carolina campaign finally has a leader after months of ramping up staff in the state. The Post and Courier reports that Jarvis Houston was tapped as the campaign's state director and is over a team of more than 30 staffers in the state. Houston was most recently a chief of staff to a New York State senator and has experience in managing campaigns. And Senator Bernie Sanders' campaign said that he hired Marco Blanco as its Latinx outreach coordinator in South Carolina and Trayvon Adams as its student outreach coordinator. That brings the Sanders Palmetto campaign staff up to 52. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is here with some state trivia? He is. Hello, Russ. What you got?
Hello. Glad to be here again. Well, our producer made a special request that we do something concerning coroners.
Coroners. Okay.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about constitutional officers and we've talked about local officials, but I don't think we've talked about coroners. There's one in every county, all 46 counties. They are elected just like other countywide office holders. And, of course, their primary job is to determine the cause of death. In routine deaths or people that die of natural causes, accidental deaths, self-inflicted wounds from violence and that kind of thing. But sometimes there are extenuating circumstances surrounding a death, and it can get kind of complicated. So our question is, who would have the final say over a cause of death in a coroner's jurisdiction? A, the county coroner. B, the county sheriff.
C, the
state medical examiner. D, the circuit solicitor over that particular county. The coroner, the sheriff, the state medical examiner, or the circuit solicitor.
They all walk into a bar, and there's a dead body. Who done it?
No, if they get into one of these gray areas,
sure.
From extenuating circumstances, like there was
Michael Jordan's father, for
things
example.
Were questionable. There's community pressure to do something. A lot of people said that can't be what happened. You know, sometimes pressure.
Wasn't that Michael Jordan's father who died in Chesterfield that they cremated because they didn't know who it was? And it's a whole ordeal.
I don't remember.
Cut all that if it doesn't make sense. But yeah, I mean that was a big thing. Are you talking about like if there's some sort of
if there needs to be,
if there was some sort
some
of like,
second guessing yeah. or
or like or challenger
sleds,
authority or
sleds
like,
called in to investigate a local that type of thing.
I'm gonna defer to state medical examiner.
Well, the answer is A, the county coroner.
I had a feeling it was gonna be a trick question like that. It's like this is it.
The coroner has the final say. Now, the coroner has some tools at his or her disposal to help them. They can bring in a medical examiner. Or they can even do something you don't hear a lot about these days, an inquest, where a six-member jury is drawn just to consider details of the cause of death. You don't hear too much of that, but it's still on the books. And, of course, coroners, for many, 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 many years, there were no qualifications to be coroner. That has changed slowly over the years. In 2017, the legislature even put some new qualifications on there. Just like sheriffs, for many, many years, there were no qualifications other than the voters decided.
State Superintendent of Education was also that way, too.
Yeah, you should be coroner or you should be sheriff.
That's a dead body. They're dead.
An interesting fact, in Marlborough County, there was a longtime coroner who served for 30 years or so and was blind. Now, that was also, he did have at his disposal a very prominent, highly regarded physician in Bennettsville that was available to assist him, if he felt he needed that type of assistance.
Well, Russ, thank you for that very somber trivia. So, yeah, vote for a coroner because they got the final say over how you died in your county.
They're the last one.
Whether they're blind or not.
Yeah, and they're the last one to let you down.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and southcarolinapublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. Follow us on Instagram at @SCLeadPod, where you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at @SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag, that is. I know you guys are hearing us out there. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. And thank you, everyone, who sent us some nice emails this past week. It's good to know that you're out there. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier and the Associated Press. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on September 12th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening. Secret message. Make sure to try this in a well-ventilated area.
Season 3. More like season snooze. Snooze and Lucci.